The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. The 10 vows of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, which is what we've been talking about, speak of what those fledgling bodhisattvas aspire to and commit themselves to practicing in order to realize the massive undertaking of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, who's talked about in the Avatamsaka Sutra. I like to think of myself as fledgling bodhisattva. I like the term fledgling. It reminds me of my birds. And if you've ever watched birds learn to fly, when they fledge, they're not too good at it. They've got the basic principle in mind, but they tend to overshoot their perch. They fall off of things. They usually are able to pick themselves up and carry on, but it's definitely not a perfect process. And this idea of the fledgling bodhisattva reminds me of a TV program that my late master was very fond of, which was called The Greatest American Hero, in which a person finds or is taken up into an alien vessel and is given a suit, special suit, which endows him with supernatural powers in which he can save the entire world with. The problem is that he loses the instruction book. So when he puts the suit on, it has all these powers, but they don't function according to his will. He ends up doing things completely accidentally and does end up doing the right thing, but often in a somewhat unusual and messy manner, not unlike myself and other beings I know. The 9th vow of Samantabhadra, which is the next one, focuses the preceding 8 vows on the practice of the bodhisattva. As I've already explained to you, I hope, adequately, the preceding 8 vows are all intimately connected with the teaching of the bodhisattva. They're interwoven into the bodhisattva vows, the training of bodhisattvas. But this one in particular emphasizes the training of someone who would realize Samantabhadra Bodhisattva's teaching in relation to others. Because the 9th vow is called to live in harmony with living beings, to constantly accord with living beings, to accommodate all sentient beings for their own benefit. And the scripture says, "Moreover, good man, to constantly accord with living beings is explained like this. Throughout seas of kshetras in the 10 directions," kshetras are the Sanskrit term for Buddha lands, each land being a place where a Buddha manifests itself and teaches. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, there are hundreds of trillions of billions of Buddha lands. "Throughout seas of kshetras in the 10 directions, exhausting the Dharma realm and the realm of empty space, there are many different kinds of living beings. That is to say, those born from eggs, womb-born, moisture-born, transformationally born, as well as those who live and rely on earth, water, fire, and air for their existence. There are beings dwelling in space and those who are born in and live in plants and trees. This includes all the many species and races with their diverse bodies, shapes, appearances, lifespans, families, names, and natures. This includes their many varieties of knowledge and views, their various desires and pleasures, their thoughts and deeds, and their many different deportments, clothing, and diets. It includes beings who dwell in different villages, towns, cities, and palaces, as well as gods, dragons, others of the eight divisions, humans and non-humans alike. Also, there are footless beings, beings with 2 feet, 4 feet, and many feet with form and without form, with thought and without thought, and not entirely with thought and not entirely without thought. I will accord with and take care of all these many kinds of beings, providing all manner of services and offerings for them. I will treat them with the same respect I show my own parents, teachers, elders, arhants, and even the thus come ones. I will serve them all equally without difference. I will be a good doctor for the sick and suffering. I will lead those who have lost their way to the right road. I will be a bright light for those in the dark night and cause the poor and destitute to uncover hidden treasures. The Bodhisattva impartially benefits all living beings in this manner. Why is this? If a Bodhisattva accords with living beings, then he accords with and makes offerings to all Buddhas. If he can honor and serve living beings, thus he honors and serves the thus come ones. If he makes living beings happy, he is making all the thus come ones happy. Why is this? Because all Buddhas, the thus come ones, take the mind of great compassion as their substance. Because of living beings, they bring forth great compassion. From great compassion, the Bodhi mind is born, and because of the resolve for Bodhi, they accomplish equal and proper enlightenment. It is like a great king of trees growing in the rocks and sand of a barren wilderness. When the roots get water, the branches, leaves, flowers, and fruits will all flourish. The Bodhi tree king growing in the wilderness of birth and death is the same. All living beings are its roots. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are its flowers and fruits. By benefiting all beings with the water of great compassion, one can realize the flowers and fruits of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas' wisdom. Why is this? If all Bodhisattvas benefit living beings with the water of great compassion, they can attain anuttara samyak sambodhi, complete and perfect enlightenment. Therefore, Bodhi belongs to living beings. Without living beings, no Bodhisattva could perfect the unsurpassed proper enlightenment. Good man, you should understand these principles in this way. When the mind is impartial towards all living beings, one can accomplish full and perfect great compassion. By using the heart of great compassion to accord with living beings, one perfects the making of offerings to the thus come ones. In this way, the Bodhisattva constantly accords with living beings. Even when the realm of empty space is exhausted, the realms of living beings are exhausted, the karma of living beings is exhausted, and the afflictions and suffering of living beings are exhausted, I will still accord endlessly, continuously in thought after thought without cease. My body, mouth, and mind never weary of these deeds. Thus is the ninth vow of Samantabhadra. Now, Mahayana Buddhism and our tradition of serene reflection teach that all sentient beings possess Buddha nature, and they are Buddha nature. All beings have the ability and capacity to become Buddha, to attain Buddhahood. And we are able to do so by first becoming Bodhisattvas through this aspiration to realize Buddhahood, Buddha nature, and then of attaining it through training, specifically by awakening bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, the yearning for Buddha nature, the aspiration for enlightenment, practicing the bodhisattva vows, practicing the six paramitas, six perfections. Someone who cannot achieve Buddhahood in this lifetime, and there are a number of reasons why people can't achieve Buddhahood in this lifetime, usually because of the weight of their karma, although in every generation there are at least some who either achieve Buddhahood or make a darn good step towards it. If one is unable to do so, then the depth of their sincerity, their awakening, their resolution to train, the ongoing effort that they make in this life ensures that they will do so in the future. This is the teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. Because of this, if we are able to not doubt this outcome, and if we are able to accept this in a realistic way, we can train with faith and confidence. Not be afraid, not become discouraged by our own shortcomings and our own mistakes, and not become despairing or disheartened by the seeming terrible state of the world around us. Someone who cannot achieve Buddhahood is assured of realizing it in the future. This is what the Buddha teaches. It's what the scriptures teach. However long it may take to do so. And what we need to do, therefore, whether we are just starting on the path, whether we are fledgling bodhisattvas, or whether we are at the point of the pilgrim Sudana in the Avatamsaka Sutra, who's on the brink of realizing Samantabhadra Bodhisattva's vows, we can awaken the vow to train, resolve to do it, and continue to make the effort of the training throughout our lives. And when we come to the time of sickness and death, we can recognize it as a going forward and not as a stopping or an ending or an, oh blank, I've blown it. It is one more step on the way to Buddhahood. Looking at things in this way helps to bolster and renew one's faith and confidence in Buddhist training. Faith and confidence is one of the characteristics, should be one of the characteristics of training. As I said, a bodhisattva called an enlightening being, a bodhisattva with a small b, is any being who aspires to enlightenment, or, as I would prefer to say, aspires to fully realizing Buddha nature, their union with Buddha nature. Any being who does this is a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is a Buddha to be, someone who is treading the path of awakening to Buddha nature. And we're all in different stages. We're all at different steps of doing that. Treading the path of Buddha nature happens by awakening within oneself what Dogen calls the desire to train, the aspiration for enlightenment, what Reverend Master called the seed of training, the yearning for training. In Buddhist language, this is called bodhicitta. And embracing the four vows of the bodhisattva. Whether we know it or not, when we take the precepts at Jukai, we are already becoming fledgling bodhisattvas. It's sort of like enlisting in the army. You've enlisted in the army, and all of a sudden, just by virtue of your enlistment, they've slanted you towards special forces. You know, you're not only going to do it, you're really going to do it. Okay? Well, as soon as you take the precepts, without anybody really saying anything, you are taking the bodhisattva vows as well. And I've tried to make that point here when we do Jukai, when we give the precepts, by having the renewal of vows just after we've taken them. Because you know that if you really take them, you have to renew them on a regular basis. And also it makes the point of remembering that in addition to precepts, we are becoming fledgling bodhisattvas. The bodhisattva vows, for those of you who may not be familiar with them, are, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. Any being can become a bodhisattva. And I would say that once you have embarked on the bodhisattva path, you will very quickly see that there are beings, many beings, all beings are on that path as well. They too are bodhisattvas. To be a bodhisattva is to see bodhisattvas everywhere. That term, bodhisattva, presupposes that one aims to bring all beings, not just oneself, but everybody, to realizing Buddha nature. That not only I, but all beings will become Buddha. It's because of this teaching, this importance of the bodhisattva that Mahayana Buddhism stresses service, helping, selfless service to all beings, rather than escape from the fetters of existence that bind one to the realm of birth and death, as the primary reason for training. It's there, but it's not the primary reason. For fledgling bodhisattvas, for them of us who take the bodhisattva vow, our job to be here is training, yes, but it is the training that helps all beings. The bodhisattva trains to cleanse his or her karma, and works to sever the fetters of greed, hate, and delusion, which bind him or her to samsara, to the world of birth and death. Yes, this is a given. But the job's not over until we can take everybody with us. And the positive aspect of rebirth is that we keep coming back and coming back and coming back to perfect the job and to help and enable other beings to do so as well. And certainly, if you saw the news over the past week, you'll realize what a considerable undertaking that is at the moment and will be in the future. For someone who correctly understands this, Buddhist training becomes something much broader than purifying one's karma and dealing with one's suffering. Yes, this is essential. And it's much bigger than that. The Bodhisattva vow and the Bodhisattva training magnifies the importance of the relationships that we have with all beings. It makes those relationships even that much more important, because these relationships become the way in which we purify karma and the way which enables us to realize Buddhahood and to help other beings realize Buddhahood as well. So keeping Samantabhadra Bodhisattva's ninth vow to live in harmony with living beings, and what I've said about the Bodhisattva vow in mind, let's look a little bit at the training of us fledgling Bodhisattvas as we attempt to realize these vows. Reverend Master used to teach that when a person decides to live by meditation and the precepts, if they make a sincere attempt to do that and put hard work into it, eventually, inevitably, that work and that sincerity is going to bear fruit. That fruit manifests itself by a change in outlook. Training works for us, and as we train and as we see that it works, we start to change. Subtly at first, but it's very much like some of the trees that grow around here. You see this, you know, the trees growing straight up like this. You see this branch growing in a slightly different direction than all the branches. Well, if you leave that to be, it's going to end up way out here somewhere. Its growth is minuscule. It's growing just a little bit every year, but given enough time, it's way out here. Buddhist training does that too. It's kind of sneaky. It sneaks up on you. It changes you very slowly. And yet if you continue to do it over and over and over the years, you find yourself with an outlook that may be significantly different, even radically different, than your friends who are not Buddhist or in relationship to the world around you. Many people don't realize that the Buddha was probably the greatest social revolutionary who ever lived, but he never talked about social revolution. He just did his training and let things happen by themselves. How does that outlook change? Well, what was once so darn important to us is no longer very important. And the things that used to matter or used to take primary focus or have primary importance in our lives no longer does so. What does come to matter most importantly, in addition to the sort of obvious of practicing meditation and living by the precepts, is the necessity of living simply and of expressing that simplicity in one's own training by living according to what we would call the four wisdoms, or the what Dogen called the four exemplary acts of the bodhisattva: charity, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy. And in addition to that, practicing gratitude. This is what becomes important. It's what begins to take shape in front of one as this change in outlook is going on. When you take these simple things, meditation, Buddhist morality, living by the precepts, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, and you add to that gratitude, you have a really simple recipe that is easy enough to follow for anybody. Anybody can do this. And yet that recipe is powerful enough to transform each and every one of us into a Buddha, and to turn the seething turbulence of samsara into the garden of nirvana. One doesn't have to do anything glitzy or exotic. One doesn't have to live by esoteric secret mysteries. One doesn't have to spend a ton of money on finding the secret. One doesn't have to live by complicated philosophical principles that one is constantly having to amend, defend, and inflate. One doesn't have to engage in spiritual athletics, you know, endlessly engaging in long retreats, exotic retreats, and other feats of spiritual prowess. All one has to do is meditate deeply, sincerely, cleanse one's heart by living by the precepts, practice these four acts of the bodhisattva, and show gratitude by living a life that's dedicated to helping other beings. This is what enables us to live in harmony with beings, to accord with them, to accommodate to them, to adapt with and for them. This is what helps us to keep, to manifest Samantabhadra's vow. The four acts of the bodhisattva: charity, giving alms, tenderness or speaking kindly, benevolence or learning to be skillful with beings, and sympathy, learning to be at one with others. This These four things are the everyday behavior of someone who lives by the precepts and is actualizing Buddha nature in their everyday life. This is what you see in them. The presence of these four things in our life shows us that we're going in the right direction. They're showing us that our training is working, that we're doing something right. For those of you who know, Buddhist training is often like walking in the dark. You very seldomly, if ever, have the experience of the lights going on and saying, you're doing it right. Or you come, you get up in the morning and it's there in red on your ceiling. Or, a huge hot air balloon is going by the house. You're doing it right. Doesn't happen very often. The presence of these four things, and again I'd add gratitude to this, is how you tell if someone is doing well in their training. That a person is following the precepts correctly. River Master used to say, this is how you tell how enlightened a person is. And because of that, I tend here not to look at how well someone meditates or how profound their experiences are or how many retreats they do or what sort of talks they give or what sort of a dashing or charming figure they project as they go about their lives. I look for these instead. People tell me that I give good talks, and if that is so, I'm very grateful for that. I know how lacking I am in these four things. So it's very difficult for me to get cocky about giving talks. I manage occasionally, but usually the damper comes down fairly quickly. These are old friends to us, for those of us who studied with Reverend Master, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, because they were taught, encouraged, emphasized, and expressed very well by her in daily life. Even though they're old friends, I'd like to look at them more closely, especially in connection with Samantabhadra's vow. As I've mentioned to you many times, it's vital to approach the Dharma as a bridge. It is a bridge between the way we are now and the way we can be. If we don't see the Dharma, the teachings, the practices, as a bridge, we tend to idealize them. We think of, for example, the Four Wisdoms in terms of what we are not. And we idealize what we think they are. In terms of charity, I look at myself at all the times when I am not charitable, and I think, oh, it's not that, and it's the opposite of that. And in doing that, or if I think of it in that way, I tend to bring it down to my own level of where I, quote, am in my training, where I think I am. I never am where I think I am. You never are where you think you are. In doing so, to bring it down to one's own level of understanding or misunderstanding, as the case may be. And then we end up discounting and disparaging our own ability to practice it. The teachings are a bridge. Where we are now, where we can be. I am here today. I can practice charity in another step. This is the purpose of the teachings, to show me how to do that. Even if you are tormented by greed, hate, and delusion, if you sincerely learn to meditate and work on the precepts, the practice of the four exemplary acts are going to show themselves in your life, if only the necessity of them. But you know, the necessity of them is the beginning of their appearance. I need to be more generous. I need to be more charitable. I need to learn to speak more kindly. I need to learn to be more skillful. I need to learn to live at one with my spouse, my parents, my kids, my community, my world. The necessity of that is the beginning of their appearance. And when we recognize the necessity, it means that the meditation practice, the keeping of the precepts, are working. They're showing us, hey, Echo, you need to do this. Oh, I need to meditate. I'm not meditating here. I need to meditate more deeply. I need to keep the precepts in this situation, in this particular way. These are those teachings appearing in our life as a result of attempting to practice them. And they are creating the bridge between the way we are now, the way we can be. So, these four wisdoms, when they show themselves, they will show themselves first as the necessity of showing them, as the necessity of doing them, and then as the practice of doing them. It's important when learning to see this in the same way, in this idea of creating the bridge and not idealizing these things, is not to look at your meditation practice as something that is outside of your own mind. Meditation exists in relationship to you. When you meditate, you will experience meditation. When you do not meditate, you will experience not meditating. You will know the difference. You will want to meditate more deeply. And when you do meditate, you will say, oh yes, I want to do this. I don't want to do the non-meditating part. It's too painful. It's too difficult. Same with the precepts. Oh yes, I want to keep this precept. When I don't, it hurts. The keeping of the precepts is not something outside of your own body, speech, and mind. It is your own body, speech, and mind. It is that experience, as is the practice of meditation. And it's just as important to understand these four exemplary acts as the actions which express themselves within our own behavior, as the fruit or the lack of fruit of our training. When you meet someone who has been training for a long time, and they are very accomplished. They are going to express charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy as fruits the size of huge watermelons hanging off them. You know? Now, maybe when we look at ourselves, all we have are crab apples. But today's crab apple is tomorrow's watermelon. Remember that. Every one of us is a bridge to and a bridge of the Dharma. No matter how beginning or advanced you are, you're going to experience meditation and the necessity of it, the precepts and the necessity of it, necessity of them. Charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, and the necessity of them. In your own life, in your own mind, in your own speech, in your own body, in your actions, in your interactions. The lack, the necessity, the practice, and the fruit of them in your own way and in your own life. Don't think of them as being way over there and you're way over here. You are the bridge. Your training is the bridge. Practice of the Dharma is the bridge. When we meditate, we become aware of the arising of karma and of karmic consequence. If you sit and you look at a wall and you pay attention to what's going on when you are sitting there, you are going to see the seeds of suffering that we've planted in the past, and we are going to experience the bitter harvest of reaping them. We are also going to become aware of the ways in which we create suffering in the present, and through the study and practice of the precepts, learn how to refrain from creating more suffering and perpetuating that suffering. There is even more to this, in that one not only learns how to refrain from creating suffering, but one actually learns what good is and how to do it, and how to do it for others. How does one do it for others? Charity, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy. Charity, the making of offerings. Tenderness, speaking kindly. Benevolence, learning to be skillful. Sympathy, being at one with beings. Realistically, our meditation practice are teaching us how to learn from all the suffering we've created and how to diminish that suffering in the future, how to make it smaller, how to make it less. Will you be able to totally eliminate all suffering in your lifetime? Well, I don't know. You can just do the very best you can. That's what I'm going to do. And it's a plan, you know. It's really important to, in this process of meditation and precepts, to learn the meaning of the precepts, their spirit, and keep that spirit alive in everything you do. The spirit of keeping the precepts: cease from evil, do only good, do good for others. This is their spirit. This is why the three pure precepts, I call them the precepts of intention. Ceasing from evil, ceasing from harm. Doing as little harm as possible. One doesn't really get these precepts too well until one really begins to sift through and cleanse one's karma. But once you start doing that, you get them with a vengeance. You begin to understand why they are important, why they are here, and why we learn from them and need to practice them. They help us to uncover those habits and actions of body, speech, and mind, which, as I said, not only creates suffering, but perpetuates it. The more we become aware of the habits and actions, the more we apply meditation and precept keeping to our training, the deeper and deeper we understand how the precepts work for us. How to cease from suffering, to do good for others, both for, with, and through us. How to do that. The more we can do that, the more still we can and will become, the more bright and alive we will become. The more faith and confidence we'll have in training. As this becomes deeper, the more we will see the necessity of not only living by the precepts, turning them within, practicing them on a deeper and deeper level, but learning how to live from them. And how to live in a compassionate way that will manifest them and help other beings. This is what the four exemplary acts is all about. As I said earlier, putting the precepts into practice, meditating deeply, the four exemplary ways of the Bodhisattva, these are the fruit of doing that. We learn to how to live from them and express them in a compassionate way in the world around us. This place where we do this, this arena of training, this is where the four exemplary acts manifest themselves. It's where they express themselves. It's where you will find the need to practice them, where you will find the opportunity to practice them. And they will show themselves to you and teach you how to harmonize with beings in accordance with Samantabhadra's vow. In the Shushogi, Dogen wrote about this mind of the awakening of the Bodhisattva, this aspiration, and the training of a Bodhisattva, when he said, "When one awakens to true wisdom, it means that one is willing to save all living things before one has actually saved oneself. Whether a being is a layman, a priest, a god, or a human being, enjoying pleasure or suffering pain, he should first awaken this desire as quickly as possible. However humble a person may appear to be, if this desire has been awakened, the person is already a teacher of all mankind. A little girl of 7 even may be the teacher of the 4 classes of Buddhists, and the mother of true compassion to all living things. One of the greatest teachings of Buddhism is its insistence upon the complete equality of the sexes. However much one may drift in the six worlds and the four existences, even they become a means for realizing the desire for Buddhahood once it has been awakened. However much time we may have wasted up to now, there is still time to awaken this desire. Although our own merit for Buddhahood may be full ripe, it is our bounden duty to use all this merit for the purpose of enlightening every living thing. At all times, there have been those who put their own Buddhahood second to the necessity of working for the good of all other living things. So there you have Dogen speaking of the awakening of this mind. And then he goes on to talk about the four exemplary acts: charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, which we will continue on with next week. Thank you, friends.